On this episode of Aviator Cast, an interview with Josh Flowers from Aviation 101.
Welcome, aviators, to another episode of Aviator Cast. Load up your flight bag with useful flight training topics, interviews, and aviation passion. Let's kick the tires and light the fires. Coming to you from Angle of Attack Headquarters in Homer, Alaska, here's your host and flight instructor, Chris Palmer.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Aviator Cast. My name is Chris Palmer. I hope that you are doing well wherever you are. You're staying healthy. You're keeping your social distance. You're not going too crazy, getting cabin fever. Just hope that this podcast finds you well. So today we're going to do something a little bit different that I used to do quite a bit, and that is an interview with a fellow aviator. Today I'm going to have on the show my good friend Josh Flowers from Aviation 101. He creates amazing YouTube videos. He and I both got the opportunity to collaborate when he came up to Alaska last summer, and he created amazing, amazing material that really showed better than I could my side of flying here in Alaska. He is an amazing creator, filmmaker, and I know that you guys will really enjoy his material if you haven't heard about it before. And we have a really good and quality conversation here between friends about YouTube and how people can get into aviation, also get into some of the safety aspects that we have come across over the years as we've grown as aviators. So there's lots of great material here to get through. So let's get into it. Let's get into Hangar Talk with Josh Flowers from Aviation 101. All right, everyone. We are very honored to have a special guest with us today. We have my friend Josh Flowers coming to us from Texas. How you doing, Josh?
I'm pretty good. How you doing, man, up there in Alaska?
Good. Well, quarantine. It's okay. Quarantine. But, you know, we're surviving.
I'm quarantined too, but yeah, make the best of it, I guess. Read some books.
Okay, so here's one thing I'm jealous about. If you truly are on quarantine, you can't, like, go get takeout food. So what's the last takeout food you got? Have you been getting takeout?
You're going to hate me for this. I went and got Panda last night.
No, I knew it.
Yep.
Yeah, I shouldn't have asked that question.
As soon as you asked that, I was like, oh man, he's not going to like this.
I legally can't even go to like Anchorage where they have Panda right now. I can't do anything. And actually, I can't even go to any local restaurant. So anyway, interesting time.
Can you leave your house though? Like, can you go on a walk?
Yes. You can do that, but I can't go to any public places. So I literally can't go to the grocery store right now.
How do y'all get your stuff? Like, are you having anybody bring it to you or what?
Yeah, just family. So Okay. Have family bring it. And then I got permission to be here at work. So we're all kosher. We're good. Let's rewind the clock. Usually when I start an interview, I ask people how they fell in love with aviation. I think for you, if I know right, it started at a pretty young age, and it was pretty clear at a young age that you were going to go for this. So how did you get the aviation bug? How did you fall in love with aviation?
Yeah, it was through my dad. So he got his license in 1979, and in 1983, he bought a Cessna 172. It's a 1980 Cessna 172. So it was like, really new and super nice when he bought it. And he owned it for about 17 years or so. Sold it in 1999. So I was 3 years old when he sold the plane. I had super vague memories of flying in it with him. I actually kind of remember the last flight that we took, which is kind of straight. You know, like, I was 3 years old. That's a long time ago. But very vague memories of being terrified, like flying in the back of the plane. And then when the plane sold, and I kind of got older, and there was just that interest. It was like that little spark that was just lots of curiosity there. And I just started asking questions. And then when I was about 14, I kind of talked about it with my parents, and they were like, seems like he's interested in flying, so why don't we get you into a discovery flight? So we did. And I pretty much just started flying every now and then from there. And as time progressed, turned 16, I soloed, turned 17, got my private. And then from there, instrument commercial, CFI, all that good stuff.
So what were some of the steps that you took that early on to be able to solo, say at 16, private at 17, et cetera?
The main thing was consistency, to just keep flying at a steady cadence. But when you're that young, at least for most people, when you're that young, you're like a sponge. You absorb things really, really well. So I didn't have to fly super often. I was actually flying once every 2 weeks. So every other week, I'd go on just a hour and a half lesson. But I was absorbing stuff really well. I was also doing a lot of reading, a lot of studying on my own time. Whenever somebody asks me, I get the question a lot, you know, I'm too young to get into flying, or maybe like they can't afford it right now. How can I get my foot in the door? And I always tell them, like, go read airplane flying handbook and the pilot's handbook of aeronautical knowledge. Just go read those. They're free documents online. So that's the kind of thing that I was doing. Just gain as much knowledge as I can. And then by the time I turned 16, it was just, you know, my CFI and I, George, we had flown so much together that he was just like, yeah, you're 16 now, go solo. And I did. And then pretty much for a whole year, I didn't really see him that much. You know, I would just kind of like get fly and, you know, renew the endorsement and all that kind of stuff. And I just soloed for like an entire year. And then I, you know, turned 17 and like right in the middle of some busy times of school. So it was like a month after my 17th birthday that we finally were able to go ahead and get ready for the check ride. I took it like 2 months.
Do you remember
after my birthday.
How many hours you had when you got your license? Like, was it at minimum?
Yeah.
It seems like you would have more hours than
I did. Normal. I had 85.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause you know, you turn 16 solo, you know, just keep soloing
right.
over and over and over again. So I built up a bunch of hours that probably if age wasn't a restriction there, I would have been able to just go through it and probably get the minimum. But yeah, I had about 85 when I got my certificate.
So, why don't you tell the audience, for those that have been living under a rock and haven't seen either one of us, collaborate together. Cause we'll talk more about our Alaska trip, later on. But, for those that aren't familiar with you, tell them about your other vocation and how you've actually made a career out of aviation and what you're doing in film.
Yeah, it's really interesting or unique, I guess, how I've kind of made a career about it. Whenever somebody asks me what I do for a living, I often don't even divulge it because I don't want to explain it to them. I'll usually just be like, oh, I'm a flight instructor. And that's like the simplest way I can just explain it. But I've always had a deep burning passion for filmmaking and cameras. Ever since I can remember as a kid, I had a camera in my hand. So when I got old enough to start flying, I figured out how I could combine these two things through this thing called YouTube. And it's a pretty dangerous weapon when you put a YouTube account in the hands of a 14-year-old. And I found that out pretty quick. And especially putting myself out there, like showing my training as like, you know, 15, 16-year-old, putting it out there on YouTube, and people are learning from it. But I'm also like showing things that I probably shouldn't show. Mainly I was like showing mistakes that I was making and I wasn't giving any context. So like it took me a while to learn how to effectively do that, but I turned it into what's now Aviation 101. This is my 10th year doing the whole YouTube thing. And it's pretty much turned into a full-time career just with, you know, just showing people how they can apply aviation with their private pilot certificate, go out and like take a 172, an average airplane that like everybody has access to, and how can you do something awesome with it? So I take these crazy long trips on our Skyhawk, or, you know, like the last trip I took out west, took a buddy and his Cherokee, and we just went on this trip that most people don't imagine a Cherokee going on,
right?
And that kind of stuff. And it's turned into a full-time career. You know, I'm always sitting back here editing and spending all my time trying to figure out how to tell another story in aviation, and then also teach people something along the way.
Awesome. Yeah. So what, cause I share a similar story, cause I do video as well, and found myself as a young boy, like, what I would do, how I kind of got in the film, is I'd do these World War II models and I'd pack them with firecrackers and then I'd film them blowing up.
We've talked about this. I did the same thing.
You did.
I did the same thing.
Yeah. So what are like some of your early filmmaking memories of just playing with the family camera, basically?
Well, I remember I had this, I forget the name of the company. It's a big company that manufactures like toy cars or model cars, but these are like really detailed, you know, replicas of like a Jaguar or something. And I remember this one particular, it was a Jaguar and it was like light blue. And I remember loading it up with miniature explosives, firecrackers and stuff. And, it was a Hi8 camera, you know, recording on the little Hi8 cassettes. And, recording at 30 frames a second, I think is what it was, or it might've been 60 interlaced frames. So I was able to slow it down a little bit and, you know, just recording this, you know, absolutely obliterating this model car and putting it in slow motion. That's one of the original memories I have. I would build stuff like cardboard houses, like a house out of cardboard or like a building, and I would wire it up with firecrackers, but I wouldn't just have fuses and light them. You know, I would actually run filaments hooked up to a battery and like have a detonator.
Crazy.
And that's, I've almost killed myself with electricity many times too, but but yeah, that's kind of how I got started with like playing with cameras, staging some scenes with like lighting and all this kind of stuff. And that was all just like playing with the family, you know, home movie camera and you know, getting acquainted with editing software and all that kind of stuff. And then it just kind of took off from there, especially when I involved flying with it. But I don't rig planes with explosives. Don't take that.
Yeah,
from that.
No. Planes, explosives, they don't mix very well. So
No.
It's so interesting how similar that is. Cause I would build these Lincoln log cities, kind of like old Western cities. Yeah. And actually this was very bad in the house. I put like matches in between the logs and we'd light them on fire in the house.
Hmm.
And my mom saw the film later that we made and she's like, you guys were playing with fire on the carpet. And it's like, yeah, that wasn't a good idea. But we got it on film and it was great. And the story was amazing. Anyway. So walk us through what it's been like growing on YouTube over the years as you are, I guess, even gaining experience. So maybe some of the pitfalls, the pros, cons, et cetera, of that process.
Right. Well, I think the biggest thing that I've taken away from it is YouTube has taught me how to be humble and not be afraid to call out my own shortcomings, my own mistakes, that kind of stuff. Early on, you know, of course, as a 14-year-old kid, you're indestructible and you know everything, right? And unfortunately, that came across on my YouTube videos early on. And I learned very quickly that, you know, how much... people on YouTube will call you out on anything. And I think that was kind of a godsend starting out because it helped me grow a lot faster in that mentality of how important it is to be humble in aviation and really know where your limits are. And if you screw something up, don't be afraid to call yourself out on it and debrief it on camera and talk about what happened. And I think over the years, that's probably been the most important thing that's come out of it. Growing on YouTube and gaining my personal flying experience and all that kind of stuff in the eyes of the world through cameras on YouTube, it's pretty rough. You got to grow some thick skin and you've got to grow up fast. And I know you know that pain as well. It's something that really kind of forced me to step on the accelerator of growing that mentality of okay, we're in this thing called aviation. It can kill you. You don't know as much as you think you know, and you've got to know that. Like, you've got to be aware of that. And I think that's the big thing that YouTube's taught me. And then on the other side of things, people have, you know, brought up topics in the comments on the videos every now and then that are actually really juicy and really good. And it causes me to want to dive deeper into a subject. And somebody will say, hey, you know, like, recently I got somebody talking about the mag check. And I showed a shot of my dad's hand turning the key. And somebody made a good point of like, oh, you know, you can do it either way, but I like the fact that y'all do the two clicks over to left or right mag, depending on the switch, and then back to both, and then do the one click and then back to both, because there's a less chance of you taking off on one mag, that kind of stuff. People will bring up like little tips that you normally wouldn't have access to if you're just, you know, flying with your CFI every now and then. So I think social media is really opened my eyes to just how much information there is out there, valuable information, but it's also opened my eyes up to how much of a voice it gives to haters and people who just kind of like don't have anything nice to say. And that's the part where you just got to grow thick skin and just, you know, and just learn to be able to differentiate between people who are not really saying anything of substance and people who are actually giving you constructive criticism. But growing on YouTube has been a real treat over the years to kind of have that tool or have that kind of almost like a cattle prod to like keep me growing and keep pushing me over and over again. And I think it's been really beneficial. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah. You can't really fake it. I've noticed that there are some other YouTubers that I've seen along the way. And I think this is more the exception and not the rule, but people that like don't get that mentality of improving and using the community as this catalyst to like absorb a bunch of great information.
Right.
And I've seen a lot of people do some dangerous stuff. And of course, like someone like you that grows up through it and you're showing that entire journey, you're going to show some stuff that is just part of the growth experience. Whereas
sure,
most people have to go through that alone, you know, and they don't have the privilege of getting good comments that help them grow. So it is actually a really cool thing. That's helped me a ton too. But right, like you said, you got to have thick skin because A, you've got to be willing to just put that out there first and foremost, which a lot of people aren't. And then B, you've got to be able to sift through the stuff that's just full on like abuse or trolls and the stuff that is good critical feedback. So,
right. Yeah. It's super tricky and you've just got to have thick skin. You can't, you know, a lot of people, I do know of a lot of people online that have, or at least I've heard this over the years. Some people will say something randomly like, you know, oh, I saw Josh do this in a video 6 years ago. He's no good. He's a terrible pilot. And a lot of those, like, okay, that's fair. You know, like depending on what they're talking about, but also you got to understand that people grow and people change. A lot of people don't realize how much I've been taught throughout right, this entire process, like how much the whole YouTube thing and like putting my experiences out there on social media has slapped me across the face whenever I do something wrong. Like not only is it just like a slap on the wrist that, oh, I did something wrong. That was a close call. I'll try and learn from this. It's like the right, world saw it, you know?
Right.
And I think that's actually a really valuable tool. Having a YouTube channel and putting yourself out there is not for everybody. It's definitely something that kind of takes a certain level of responsibility that I didn't really understand in the beginning. But of course, now I do, especially after I became a CFI. I was like, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
There's like this whole side of responsibility here that I couldn't really see before, but now it's been unsheathed and I can see this now. And I think it's awesome because I've learned so much. I've grown so much. And almost going back and watching my videos from like 2012 is inspiring because I'll be like, wow, right, I wouldn't fly with that guy. and then, you know, of course, you know, that was 8 years ago and a lot's changed.
Yeah. And very few people get to have that perspective. And I know that even for me, when you first started your channel, I think you probably first had your license. You're flying with a bunch of guys, like doing a bunch of fun stuff in Texas. And I saw some things throughout that process. You know, I have the privilege of being born several years before you, right? So like,
right,
yeah, of course I'm going to like be a little bit ahead of that and saw some things. I'm like, man, that's pretty, I don't know about that. But honestly, if people saw what I did as a pilot a couple times when I had the choice and like I let the hazardous attitudes get the best of me, I would be destroyed. Like I did some very silly things. And I think, you know, as instructors, like you totally get, like you said, that we have a responsibility to share that now. And there really is something to be said for gaining experience and going and flying with your friends and having them push you to make decisions that aren't great or you having to have the wherewithal to stop them basically, or saying, I'm not going to participate. Those are all, I think, like soft skills that you don't really read in any textbooks, but they're super important for people to learn if they're going to have like a lifelong, safe flying career. Because otherwise, left to your own devices, people do some pretty dumb stuff. And yeah, so
right,
it sounds like you had a lot of valuable experiences of people actually teaching you that way, which is really, really cool.
Right. And I've definitely been in those situations where, you know, a friend or a group of friends kind of convinces you into a situation that like, I didn't know any better, you know, and we were all low time private pilots and we would go out and do something without briefing it or go, you know, fly into some conditions that we really shouldn't be flying into or something like that. Absolutely. That happened a bunch of times with me and I learned my lesson time and time again. And I know like you and I have been in situations before where we've had to say,
yeah,
no to the group mentality. Yep. And we've had to say,
I was
no,
just thinking about that. Yeah. We have some very specific stories from the last year.
Right.
Of where our experience has taught us that like, hey, I kind of see what's coming five steps down the road. We need to be super careful right now. So
yeah,
we can talk about those too, but,
right.
Yeah. Interesting. So have there ever been any videos that you've just full on deleted from your channel because of safety reasons?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd have to kind of think back because it's been years since I've had to do that, but, I'd have to think back on like any specifics, but, you know, just stuff like, I'm trying to think, you know, like if you're flying along at cruise, there was a, it was maybe like 2 or 3 years ago, I had a video up that somebody made, and it's a bandwagon effect on YouTube a lot of times. Like, normally right. it's not a problem unless, until one person says something about it, that comment maybe gets like 10 likes and YouTube shoves it to the top of the feed, and then people start yeah. seeing it, and then everybody else starts making comments about it.
Yeah, whereas forms the opinion.
Whereas otherwise they normally wouldn't have said anything about it. I think it was regarding, like, I had my phone in my hand. I was at cruise, trimmed out, you know, and I'm like, I'm texting somebody like, okay, you know, oh, I'm 30 minutes out, whatever. And somebody made a big deal about me being on my phone. Like, I'm pretty sure we've all done that. You know,
right.
it doesn't really matter your experience level. If you're meeting somebody at your airport or whatever, and you have cell service, you're going to check your phone and you're going to say like, oh, yeah. I'm, you know, so-and-so out, whatever. And people just made a big, big deal about that. And, I wasn't going to sit there and be like, oh, it's not a big deal. I just, like, right. it ramped up to the point where I was just like, you know what? I need to just kill this video yeah. before it grows anymore. And actually there was a time, it just reminded me, there was a video, within the last 6 months that I released that involved an aircraft, and it was like, you know, getting a demo and all that kind of stuff. And there were some safety violations. I don't like that word, but there were some safety consideration breaches that I didn't
maybe
catch.
Even just for your personal minimums that
for
that
my they were it, yeah no yeah, yeah. It was just for my personal minimums. We didn't do anything illegal, like none of that. But there were some things that I would frown upon, and I didn't catch it until after I had edited it, uploaded it, and somebody called it out in the comments and made me aware of it. And, mm-hmm. and I was like, okay, maybe this won't get too bad. Maybe the video will just kind of, you know, level out at like 30,000-40,000 views and it won't keep growing. Well, this thing was going viral. Like, I was watching the ticker just like go exponential, and I eventually yep. just killed it because the comments were getting out of hand. The comments about me just being associated with this was getting out of hand. Like, I just had to be like, we're going to go ahead and take this one down because, and yeah. then of course the people that I worked with on that video were like, why'd you take the video down? And I was like, well, this, and this. And they were like, well, that's no good reason to take it down. And I basically had to tell them, like, this is my business, not yours.
Yeah.
I decide what goes and what doesn't on this channel.
And that's always a tough thing when it comes to safety, right? Because you don't want mm-hmm. to, I don't know, like, it could even be as simple as you want to be seen as cool around your friends. Like, it could be as simple as that. And I think that's where people get really stuck, especially when you get a group mentality sure. where it can get a little tricky. Like, if I can share an example that we had in Key West, I thought we actually handled the situation pretty well. And essentially, there were a bunch of thunderstorms coming in. We were trying to find a pocket that we could get out that was clear, but we were also worried about our ability to keep land within sight. And mm-hmm. we did eventually find like that pocket to get out, but I feel like we spent a lot of time deliberating and slowing down and coming up with different options, like staying in Key West right. and things where we were super careful with like the groupthink, because like that can be a big problem when it comes to aviation safety.
We kept bringing that up throughout that conversation. We were like, I kept trying to separate myself from the conversation and be like, okay, I don't care what Chris and Cameron are thinking.
Right.
I want to make my own decision here, and then we'll talk about what our individual decisions are and see what the consensus is. Right. So yeah, we were really careful to not get into that groupthink mentality.
Yeah. So from that situation, I think that even you and I learned things that we would do different. And regardless of how deep you get into your career or what you come up against, I think it's always interesting to debrief and find ways to improve from even situations like that. And, you know, if I can like take just a really quick tangent, we had another opportunity on that trip to do something that was very irresponsible and actually dangerous mm-hmm. when it came to flying over water. And we all would not do that because it wasn't safe. For the sake of not calling people out, I'm not going to name names, but like we weren't going to go do that together.
Right. And we quickly became the not cool guys in the group, but.
Which, yeah.
Whatever.
Which doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Totally doesn't matter. At least we're the guys that stay alive a long time. So right. anyway, that was an interesting situation. So I know that like for you, from that, you wanted more convenient, flotation devices. So you got like those fanny pack devices, right?
Yeah. Which I actually don't even use anymore. They're too, like you get in the water and when you deploy them or you activate them, you still, there's one more step that you've got to do. You've got to take it and put it around your neck.
Pull it up over. Yeah.
And I'm just not a fan of that. So I actually bought like two of the big, like wraparound life vests that are manually inflatable. I spent like, you know, $250 each on them. But it's worth it.
Yeah. Like, and that's like the full geared out ones, right?
Yeah. It's kind of like the ones that it's like the ones we wore in Alaska, or like I recently went out to Catalina Island and those were borrowed, but it's the same style, the kind that goes around your neck and has the strap around the back. Yep. Yeah.
But those actually allow, cause I'm planning on getting one and like kitting out my emergency gear this summer. They actually have pockets, right? So you can like put certain gear on some your person for survival.
Yeah, so I got two of the life vests. I bought two of them that are just the regular life vest that goes around your neck and it's manually inflatable. And then they were out of stock, so I couldn't buy it. I'm going to have to order it. But there's another one that I want to get for myself. So these two regular ones will be just like for a right seat and a back seat passenger if I want to go to Catalina or whatever. I want the one that's a manually inflatable life vest, but it's an actual vest with pockets all the way down it and in the back and stuff. So that way I can have my, you know, Garmin inReach, the PLB, and I can have like a little first aid kit on me and just stuff like that. So that way that's less
fire starters.
Yeah, exactly. It's less stuff that you've got to worry about grabbing if you've got to egress the airplane. It's already on you. Don't even worry about it. Get out.
Yeah, and that's what most bush pilots do here. And not, I'm certainly not referring to myself as a bush pilot because I'm not, but I do plan on kitting that out as well and, and getting some of my friends to help me with, you know, some of the tools that they use and talking to Howard, who works with Jason Miller, about some of the tools that I can get and what will be best. So that's an interesting side that I think you and I are getting to, because the flying has become pretty, I want to avoid saying simple, but like we're on the fringe now where we're trying to improve other things like the safety of survival and things like that.
We're branching out and we're starting to do kind of more exciting things. And, you know, before, of course, like as a student pilot, going up and doing steep turns was like, whoa. But now we're like, okay, let's let's take a 1,000-mile cross country and go out over the water and fly to this beautiful island. You know, like it's we're kind of getting into that realm of, okay, we've got the experience to be able to do some of this stuff. What are the extra considerations that we've got to have in mind? And a lot of people don't think about that. Like I've seen people fly to Catalina without life vests on. Or like they don't even have them in the plane because they're like, eh, we'll swim to shore. And I'm like, not with broken legs. Like, you know.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And I kind of laugh at that argument all the time. People are like, oh, if I'm within gliding distance of land, I don't need a life vest. And I'm like, okay, sure, you can put it on land. But what if you're flying just off the coast of LA and literally it is not a safe option to put it anywhere on land? Your safest option is to put it in the water 200 yards offshore. Because if you try and put it on the sand, you're going to run over people, kill somebody. If you try and put it on a road, you're going to get hit by a car and cause a, you know, there's so many considerations to think about.
So I'm going to make a connection back to Panda Express, okay? Because I really like Panda Express. I've got a few extra pounds. And if I land an airplane like 300 yards offshore, I'm going to struggle like getting the shore. I'm just like, I'm being really honest with myself. You know what I mean? So like people, you got to be realistic about how far you can swim, what you can actually do. When you're talking about Alaska, it's freaking cold.
Yes.
You could be hypothermic, not necessarily hypothermic, but you could drown almost instantly from inhaling water, because you hit the water, it's so cold. You suck in, you take that breath of air. People drown with like just a couple teaspoons of water to start.
Right. Doesn't take much.
It's pretty wild.
Well, not to mention if you have to go down, if you have to go down in the surf or something and your leg gets broken, like, do you really think you're going to tread water out there? And people are like, oh, treading water is not hard. I can tread water for a long time. Well, that's in your perfect scenario. If you get out of the plane, you're unharmed, you know, all this kind of stuff. Okay. Maybe you'd be okay for a little bit, but just wear a life vest. I don't know. Like even flying from Borrego Valley, California, which is just west of the Salton Sea, over to Torrance, I don't cross water at all, but I wore a life vest on that flight just in case ATC was going to want to vector me out over the water. Cause I didn't know what SoCal was going to want me to do. Right. I didn't know what, you know, SoCal was going to ask me to do. And the cleanest way to get from Borrego to Torrance that I could see was go out over the water to avoid the Bravo, avoid the Charlie, you know, TFR over Disney and all that kind of stuff. So I just said, you know what? I'm probably not going to need it, but I'm going to go ahead and put the life vest on anyways. And there were a lot of comments of people being like, you're over the desert and mountains. Why are you wearing a life vest? And I explained it like six times in the video. It's most of the time that's people who like click onto the video, watch the first 3 seconds, see I have a life vest over mountains. And they're like, and then comment. I'm going to comment. And they comment on it and it's explained in the next 8 seconds.
I don't know. I think that kind of what we're touching on here is just that the path that you and I have both taken as we get deeper into our flying careers is we're really trying to improve safety and think about where things could lead and what could happen. So let's pivot there a little bit to our Alaska trip together. So you and I, we had a lot of fun down in Florida. We collaborated there. And then you decided to come up to Alaska last summer. So just as like a starter, like what was your favorite leg of the trip that we did?
I don't know. Cause I have to think back on the videos cause the actual, like I'm so consumed by the flying and the filming while I'm there that it's almost, and some people would say this is a bad thing, but I think it's actually kind of a good thing. I don't really pick up souvenirs where I go. I bring my footage back. And when I go and edit the footage, that's like the standing memory that I have in my head is the video that was produced. I would have to say when we were in Talkeetna and we went up the Ruth Glacier into the
That's true.
The amphitheater. That was the first time I think in my entire life that I not even kidding. A lot of people might be like, oh, this is just acting on camera. I could not find the words. Like I was speechless. You were there. I was just like, like clenched fists. I don't know what to even say about this right now because we're flying in between these 3,000 foot rock walls with a gnarly glacier beneath us. And it was just absolutely
and Denali
crazy.
Right there, which was a little obscured, but.
Well, still, it was I think the lighting was perfect and it was midnight.
It was amazing.
And just like, that was just one of the most magical flights I've ever had. And that's going to be hard to top. And again, I've said that
before.
We
were all alone. It was just.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've been up there before. I've been up there and I've landed on the glacier with some of the outfits there, and that was still like a really special flight. We're all alone. It was at nighttime, it was midnight, and perfectly still air, like not a bump. I think we might have hit a bump like over the Ruth Gorge, but gosh, it's at the base of Denali, and there's a bunch of different canyons, so it was amazing. We only got that, but it's really spectacular. So. Now that you've had a little bit of time to like digest the Alaska trip, what do you feel like you took away from it? How did it make you a better pilot? How did it change your perspective on life? I don't know.
Well, it did all of the above.
What did you take away from it?
It did all of the above. It changed my perspective on a lot of things. It really showed me how much I don't know about short and soft field operations. Cause before I came up there, my arrogant self got in my Skyhawk down here and got onto a grass strip. And I was like, oh, I'm going to try my short and soft field stuff. And I was, going around the pattern. I was like, all right, I feel pretty good about it. And I get up there. And as you know, cause you were sitting in the right seat, I just like fell apart and my brain went to goo and oozed out of my ears because I wasn't used to seeing these rock walls on each side of me. And my speed wasn't under control. Like I would like it to be. I normally come in fast, but I know how to arrest that in my airplane. I get into your airplane and it's like, oh, okay. This is different. This feels weird.
It's a different 172.
Yeah. And the whole takeoff thing, cause you've got the monstrous tires on it. The whole sight picture was just different, and all that kind of stuff. So it took a lot of getting used to, but it was just yet another example of how much I don't know. And all it took was to throw me into a new environment. And I was like, whoa, okay. Like, it's a Skyhawk. Like most Skyhawks fly the same. Yours has a different engine, different tires, all that kind of stuff. So it feels different, but it's a Skyhawk. For the most part, it flies the same. So that part wasn't entirely different. It was just the environment. And of course I'm like super distracted because I'm in Alaska, And then of course the non-flying part of it was Prince William Sound.
That's 4 days up there.
That was probably like the big life changing, like, whoa, just this vast area of seawater that's just like a waterfall everywhere you look.
All this
stuff is melting.
Waterfalls.
Yeah, and it's just a 400 foot waterfall just pouring out the side of a cliff face. Yeah, just absolutely amazing time.
And it's fresh water, so we can walk up to it and get a drink.
And that we did many times.
Many times. Yeah, I'm glad you did that video. It may not be in your lane. in terms of an aviation YouTube channel, mm-hmm. but you know, for me, that's what Alaska is all about. Like, I really enjoy going to Soldovia. We had a video on that people yeah. will really enjoy on Josh's channel. But Soldovia is a really cool airport to land at. It's amazing. But if you don't like get out of the plane and walk in the town and experience it, you're not going to experience it. If you just fly up to Bettles, that was a very cool trip. But if we had spent the night there, our perspective would be totally different on on that location.
Rob gave us that like the grand tour of the whole place and just seeing all like just seeing how those people live. And we even stayed there for a night and just kind of experiencing all of that was totally different. And it's one of those things where like you can't just like blow through in a day or like take a day to fly from northern Alaska to southern Alaska and think that you experienced Alaska. Give me a break. Like I spent 2.5 weeks there and there's so much that I haven't done.
We touched the surface basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why I'm probably going to come back in June, depending on what this virus does.
We'll see. Yeah. We'll see what happens.
We'll see.
A little crazy world right now. So I want to talk a little bit about actually kind of bringing in a tool that you and I used. I didn't brief you on this or anything, but a tool that you and I used when we flew from Bettles down to Nenana on our way back, because we got in a situation where we got close to CFIT. I'm not sure I'd say close, but
I wouldn't. But it started to become
our alarm bell started to go off, and we knew we needed to get out of it, basically.
Right.
So CFIT is controlled flight into terrain. We were flying around the mountains. The weather was a little bit, it wasn't even like marginal really when we went in there, but I never considered that the rain could start on top of you and just come down, which is what happened. And then as that was happening, we got into an area of smoke. And so we kind of got in this situation where almost instantly within like 2 minutes, everything went away.
Yeah. Yeah, we were down to really poor visibility. Away. Yeah. And we knew that there was rising terrain in front of us and we were going to want to climb here soon. And it was like all of a sudden it just kind of faded into like a milky white mist. And it was like, okay. We weren't close to CFIT. We had so many outs. The important thing is our wisdom, our past experience is what caused us to start setting off alarm bells in our heads individually.
Yeah, like, okay, and then how do we get out? Let's get out. Let's stop this. What do we do next?
Right. Neither of us had a warm and fuzzy anymore. It went away.
Right.
And when that happens, like, you just got to go with your gut. And we were, you know, looking at for flight and the terrain pages and stuff. And we had these amazing tools in the cockpit to help us get out of it. But ultimately, what kept us out of that situation was our aeronautical decision-making and judgment to be like, this just got way worse than we thought it was going to. We know that there's lower land that way. We're going to go that way. And then sure enough, you know, we go that way and the weather got better and we could see everything.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I felt like in that situation where everything deteriorated so quickly and our alarm bells were going off, it was nice to be able to pivot to something like for flight. Right. And you did a good job in that sense because you basically looked at the terrain very quickly and you could see on the terrain advisor, like hazard advisor, where to go. So we basically did a left 90 degree turn and went to lower terrain.
Right.
And
it was kind of like a river valley that led to lower land.
Right. Yeah. And almost immediately things improved. Like the rain went away, but then we got into more smoke and then we followed the Yukon River down. So it was interesting to come up against those situations. Do you have any advice for people, I guess, that get themselves in that situation? Like, because you've flown a lot now, so you've probably had a dozen situations where it's like, okay, something needs to change. What do we do? So what is your advice for someone that is getting into a situation like that?
Right. I think one issue is how'd you get yourself in that situation to begin with? But we're talking about like in the plane, they're already in this situation. Worry about debriefing it later. When you're in the plane, what tools do you have to help you with that? Like, even if you've got a Garmin 430, bring that thing up to the terrain page and start looking at what you've got around you. And of course, just about everybody flies with an iPad these days. Use that. I've run into a lot of pilots. And in fact, we just had this conversation with my dad about this because I'm working with Dan Grider right now to do this like AQP recurrent training series and addressing fatal accident rates and stuff. And we had this long drawn out conversation about when you're going to depart an airport or you're going to fly around terrain or fly at night, anything like that, there is no excuse to not bring up a terrain page of some sort. Like, turn on the obstacle layer on 4Flight, or bring up the terrain profile at the top, or the synthetic vision. That synthetic vision is awesome. You know, if you've got a Stratus or a Sentry, or in our case, we have the Garmin transponder that talks to the iPad, just bring something like that up. Use your resources. Not only use your resources, but know how to use them effectively. Know every little feature. You don't want to find out in a situation like that where it's kind of becoming critical, almost like life or death critical, for you to know these features and know how to access this kind of stuff. You don't want to be figuring out in that moment that you don't know how to access the terrain page or access synthetic vision. You know, sit in bed, like before you fall asleep, pull out your iPad or pull out your phone, you know, get up 4Flight and just play with it. Learn the new features. And of course, 4Flight has all the, they've got all sorts of webinars and stuff that, and online videos that walk you through all those features, but know how to use the tools that are in your cockpit. That's a big, That's a big deal.
Yeah, it was interesting because when you pulled up the map view when we were in that situation, I pulled up the synthetic vision view like right away. Like, right. And my airplane has the ability to pull in the AHARs from the airplane, so I can actually see the synthetic vision on 4Flight. Mm-hmm. So I pulled that up. You pulled out our route out. And so we had like instantly a safe way to navigate in case we did go IMC for some reason, even though we were trying to avoid it. Mm-hmm. And then you had an out to get out the other direction. And so
exactly,
I think that's, it's interesting because you talked about like not getting in the situation in the first place. You know, we could rewind the clock on that and we could talk about that. We don't need to, but it comes down to judgment first and like knowing when things are getting bad and then being willing to like knock it off and do something different.
Right.
Like you have to do something different to get yourself out of that. And then, you know, utilizing tools to assist you in that process. So It's interesting though, because I feel like on every level, we're always doing that anyway on microscopic levels, like pulling up an airport chart to see where the taxiway is so we don't do a runway incursion. Like we're always doing those minor things, but it is good to know where to go in kind of a tight situation.
Right. Well, it takes some awareness of your PIC authority to make a decision that actually does like change your route or change, you know, like when I was flying out west this last time in our Skyhawk, I was going from Phoenix to Torrance and I just had a wicked headwind. There was just no way. Like it said, I was going to get to Torrance with like 20 minutes of fuel reserve. My minimum is an hour, in VMC. Yep. It's an hour. So I just said, you know, that's not going to work. And I could have like tried to stretch it and continued going and be like, oh, well, maybe the conditions will improve as I get closer or something like that. But early on in the flight, when I saw that projection, I just said, you know what? I'm going to change my route. It's an inconvenience. I don't want to have to stop for gas again. But I was on an IFR flight plan. I called LA Center and was like, I want to divert. It's for fuel, bad headwind. I want to go here. Gas price looks good. And then they said, okay, clear direct, Borrego. Like, done. All right. Yep.
Done.
Cool.
Easy.
Yeah.
But not pushing yourself to get to go further, that get there-itis, I think is just something to be really careful about.
And so I felt my stress like immediately went away when I changed it. Right. And I, you know, redid the 430 and on 4Flight and stuff. And instead of having Torrance in the destination, now it's Borrego. And all of a sudden I've got an hour and a half of fuel reserve, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, now I'm like not even thinking about fuel. It's just not even a stressor at this point. And then made the rest of the flight enjoyable instead of me like trying to lean it, you know, and like if I can squeeze a little bit more fuel out of it. No, just you gotta have the authority to make that kind of decision. Just change it.
Yeah. And I think that practice or that skill of decision making is the most important skill we learn in aviation. Like it's way better than you being able to squeeze, like lean out the engine and get it all right so you can stretch it out and make it like. It's so much more impressive to me that someone like you would decide to divert and get the fuel stop and arrive later. Like that's how people are going to survive through their careers. Not that it's inherently dangerous what we're doing or anything, but, you know, there are just way too many stories of pilots that did push it and it did not end well.
Right. Well, it's risk mitigation.
It is what it is.
Just mitigate the risks.
Yep. Let's get back to your YouTube channel a little bit. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the positive impact that it's had on other people. Can you talk about some of the particular situations where you've gotten to fly with someone that was a viewer or something meaningful that someone said to you that your material had helped them with?
Well, that's a big reason that I love going to events like Oshkosh and Sun and Fun. It's like, given the world's condition right now, it's a real bummer that we had to cancel Sun and Fun. Like, you and I had a joint meetup at Four Flight that we were going to do, and I know that I was going to try and get somebody to ask you to yell clear. It's fun interacting with the fans in person like that, because you don't get to do that over YouTube and stuff. And a lot of people have accused me of, like, oh, you know, you just want to have meetups for narcissism reasons. You like people, you know, boosting you up. No, it just changes my life when somebody walks up to me, shakes my hand and says, I got into flying because of your videos. Like that.
Right. Yeah.
You just don't understand what it does to a person to hear that about their own work until that happens to you. Like that's the reason that I like to shake these people's hands and look them in the eye and personally thank them for supporting my work. So there's been a number of times that I've been able to fly with some followers that, you know, love the content, and we somehow work out the opportunity to fly together. There was this one kid in particular, his name was Brennan. I think he was 11 when I took him flying. It was about a year ago, or a couple years ago, actually. He was like absolutely ecstatic when his dad told him that we were coordinating a flight and like he was going to get to go fly with me. And to me, that's just, it's almost like crazy to think about that. A little kid was geeking out about the fact that he gets to go up in an airplane with me. Cause I'm like, well, I'm just like this flight instructor in Central Texas.
But, yeah, exactly.
But not only is he super ecstatic about flying and airplanes in general, it's also the fact that he sees this guy flying on YouTube and it's kind of like a mentor kind of relationship. Like they look up to this person and now they get to fly with them. And that kind of stuff just, it impacts me so much when I get to, you know, meet this kid in this example and be able to put him in the plane and we get to go up and fly and he gets to, you know, take control of the airplane. And it's just an experience that he's never going to forget. And just knowing that I made that impact and we got to like coordinate that experience and make it work, it's priceless. That's something I'll take with me forever. And of course, you know, the emails and messages that I've gotten, I've even gotten some handwritten. In fact, on the wall back here, there's a framed letter that I got from a viewer that basically explains how, you know, how my videos convinced him to get back into flying. And he attached a picture of just his instructor, like cutting his shirt tail right after his first solo, which had just happened. Like he printed out a picture of it and included it in the envelope. So I framed that. Like that's one of those things that just, if I'm ever feeling like, you know, maybe the work I'm doing isn't making an impact, or maybe it's not doing the world any good anymore. Like sometimes everybody gets that, you know, when you're kind of feeling down on your work and stuff, I just look at that letter on the wall and just, you know, look at the picture that he sent and all that kind of stuff. And it just reminds me that, okay, it is doing some good out there. And it is, you know, even though I do get hateful comments every now and then, or I get, you know, somebody telling me that, you know, I'm nothing more than a, you know, just a useless YouTuber and that kind of stuff, which does happen a lot. I can look at something like that and be reminded that, no, I'm actually inspiring some people to chase their dreams here. And that's ultimately why I do it. I like to inspire people in that regard. I know you feel the same too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally the same for me. Cause you can get all the views in the world. But it's those personal messages that really help. Like even this weekend, I was feeling a little bit down about where things were headed, and you just lose perspective. It's human nature. You lose perspective about where you're going. And at a critical time, I had someone send me a message on Instagram, you know, and it's just like, wow, that's like why I do this. Like people really are watching and it really is meaningful. And the heart and soul I'm putting into it does matter, because it is pretty lonely. Like it can be a lonely endeavor. Like I know that for you, when you were here in Alaska, you got pretty gung-ho about editing some of the first episodes, and you were literally here in this other office, like sleeping on the floor at 3 in the morning, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard
to take a power nap and keep going. Yeah. Well, it's also, and I hesitate to say this, but it can be very thankless. And I think you and I have had a conversation about that before off the record, but, and I mean that in the regard that a lot of people, like general viewers, I'm not talking about the diehard aviation nuts like we are. I'm talking about people who just kind of come across the content. And almost like I mentioned earlier, you know, somebody will watch the first 3 seconds and then pause it, go comment, why are you wearing a life vest? You're in the desert. And then they click off the video and don't even watch the rest of the hard work that I put into that video to explain that.
Right.
It's just, and that's just one example, but there's a lot of instances like that where it's just, you know, you put your heart and soul into a video and then it just flops. And we're all at the mercy of the YouTube algorithm too, which I hate with a fiery passion, because it basically dictates who sees what. And, and for example, the Prince William Sound video, I know I posted that video about boating and kayaking in one of the most beautiful places in the world on an aviation channel. So it didn't get an incredible amount of traction for that reason, but it was still a really great production telling a story of one of the most impactful set of 4 days in my life. And, and it just didn't really go anywhere. And I even got some comments on that video saying, why are you posting this here? It's not flying.
Right.
And I'm like, well, A, y'all asked for it and y'all told me that y'all wanted to see it. And B, and of course those comments aren't coming from the people that asked for it. But it's just, it can be disheartening when you put a ton of work into a video and then it just kind of flops and it doesn't get hardly any attention.
And I feel like with several of my friends that are YouTubers, you included, we all kind of help each other out when we need some perspective on things. So I know that for you, like with the Prince William Sound video, I think I told you at one point that it's just like something you have to do, like for yourself. You have to create that video for yourself, and it doesn't matter how many views it gets or what it does. That's all that matters. And sometimes it just comes to that too. For your own creative self, you have to do something. Okay, so let's pivot kind of moving toward the end of our time here together. Not the last time we'll ever spend together, but
you'll probably text me a meme or something later.
Yeah, I'll text you right after. We'll talk after this too. But we'll try to offend each other in our best way after
We're gonna try and offend each other. That's right.
That's pretty typical. Okay, so I want to get more into maybe the current events of what's happening in the world right now, because, you know, it's hard enough on the human psyche to get in the aviation, stick with it, get a license, go for a career. Obviously, there's a lot happening right now. I think maybe we can just start with, what would your advice be for someone that's starting out in aviation? Might be a little bit of a twist on current events for that right now, but it might not be all that different. So what's your advice?
Right. Anytime I get somebody asking, like, what can I do right now? Like right now, sitting at home, what can I do to get my foot in the door in aviation? And I always tell them, you know, gather as much knowledge as you can. The Airplane Flying Handbook and Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge, the PHAC, those are FAA documents. You can download those entire, like, colored, beautiful PDFs for free. I personally like the hardcover, so you can, like, go on any pilot shop online and find a bundle of those books for like $20. Yep. It's not expensive to get those books, which are such valuable resources, and just start reading them and, you know, mark them up, like write questions and all that kind of stuff. Message somebody like, you know, send me an email or probably send you. I know we get like tons of messages, but we try to answer technical questions as much as we can too. That's something you can do at home, like sitting at home right now. You can get the Airplane Flying Handbook, Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge, and just start reading them, thumb through them. Beyond that, like if you want to actually get into a plane, like if you're financially ready for that, or if you're old enough, I know I get a lot of young people coming at me with like, oh, I'm 15, I want to get into flying. I always tell them, go for the books right now. But if you're ready to get in an airplane, call up a flight school around you and book a discovery flight. Like those things are usually, I don't know what they are now. When I was learning how to fly, they were like $100. I don't know if that's kind of still what they are.
Might be more like 150 or 200 based on where you are, but around that range.
Yeah. And it's effectively like a demo flight, an introductory lesson where you get up and you're going to be in the pilot seat. You're going to have a flight instructor with you, and they're just going to kind of walk you through like a first flight. Maybe you'll like on my first discovery flight, we went and circled downtown and then kind of went and did, you know, a couple of practice landings at an airport and then came back into Austin. So discovery flight's your first like actual step in the plane. And that can either, you know, maybe after that, it's going to light the fire in you and you're going to be like, no matter what, I've got to figure out how to pay for this, you know, or it might, you know, I've even heard of some people that it's like scared the crap out of them and they're like, I can't do this, you know?
Yep. That happens.
It happens. You know, if you've got like a fear of heights, which I do, or anything like that, like, you know, it's that kind of thing where it just throws you into the environment and you can just real quick see if you like it or not. And 99% of the time you walk away from it just with your jaw on the floor. Like, I've got to do this. I have to do this. And that's where most of the people get enough of a motivational kick to just do it. But yeah, hit the books. Like that's the easiest way to just start gathering knowledge.
And it's free. It's
It's free.
I mean, yeah, if you buy the hard copies, the printed editions, they might be $20 a piece or something, but yeah, it's free. Like, you can download it and get started. And even if you stuck with just those textbooks for your entire private pilot training, you'd do pretty dang, like, you'd be great. I mean, I use that as an instructor for reference. So,
right.
Don't need to get into the weeds on who to buy your textbooks from, et cetera. I mean, I've been giving people the advice to do ground school right now if they're sure, if they're like ready to go. It's a really good time while you're at home to start going through that. So,
I've heard of a lot of people doing that too. Like, they're just saying, you know what? I'm sitting idling. Why don't I just start working on the knowledge portion of this rating that I've been trying to get for so long? Might as well, like, get after it.
In my most recent podcast, I came up with an analogy. It's like you get cleared to line up and wait, and maybe you're a little bit impatient and you actually hold the brakes and push up the power. And that's what I want people to do right now. Like, I want them to get really geared up and ready for when this releases, that we can just like take off and do so with a lot of power. So I think there is a lot to that. What advice would you give to those that are maybe discouraged right now? Whether it's with the current market, the coronavirus stuff going on, or even just discouraged about how hard it is to become a pilot?
Well, in terms of, I'll answer that in kind of two parts, I guess. In terms of current events right now, it's hard to see, like, there's lots of uncertainty in the world, and we as humans do not like uncertainty. We hate it. We hate it with a passion. And it's really hard to navigate your way through what's going on right now and try and predict what's going to happen. But my prediction is it's going to bounce back. The market's going to bounce back. There's going to be another big demand for pilots. It just looks really grim right now because nobody knows what's going to happen, or like nobody knows how long this is going to drag out. My philosophy is it surely can't drag out much longer the way things are right now, because, you know, I think there's enough people that would agree that we can't let the economy in the country just die. You know, we can't just let everything fall off a cliff and go away. So, you know, if the virus continues to spread and and it's not showing any signs of letting up anytime soon, like if it's going to go on for another year, for example, I don't know. I think everybody's going to kind of start figuring out ways that we can still operate while taking precautions and, like, you know, trying to slow the spread and all that kind of stuff, but we're still operating in the economy. So that's the way I see it, at least. I think that at least the travel portion of the stock market and the economy is really going to bounce back, because everybody I've talked to is like, when this is over, when the stay at home order is over and stuff, I'm going to go on a vacation. So do you know how many people are going to be buying airline tickets? So all these airlines are going to need their pilots back.
I was thinking about that because I was going to come to Texas right after Sun and Fun and do stuff with you. I was actually going to talk to you about maybe planning something in the fall for that instead, to just like make up for the fact that we lost that time, you know? I mean, I'm raring and ready to go.
Everybody's going to be basically trigger happy to go travel. Not to mention everybody's got cabin fever. They're stuck inside. I mean, look at you. Like, you're only allowed to go like between your house and your office right now.
Dude, yeah. Two more days.
Right. And down here, at least, we're not, like, I'm not quarantined. We're not on lockdown. It's a stay in place order. So, like, don't go out unless you have to. I'm still going to my hangar every now and then, and I'll clean the plane or just mess around in the hangar. Like, there's nothing wrong with that because I'm not interacting with a soul in between here and the hangar and back. I went and got takeout last night, which was delicious, by the way. I think it's going to bounce back. Everybody's going to want to travel, and I think there's going to be a huge demand for instructors too, because I think a lot of people after this, like, think of how many people are in ground school right now. They're like, I'm going to start on my private pilot ground school. I'm reading the books and blah, blah, blah. When all this is done, they're going to be like, discovery flight. We're going to nail this right now. And I think there's going to be a huge demand for that. The other side of that is people are financially burdened right now. So, I mean, as far as advice or like anything that words of encouragement that I could give is just hang tight, ride it out, make the most of your time sitting idle, study, read those FAA handbooks, start an online ground school, just do something to make good use of your time. And then you'll feel a whole lot better about the situation, and you'll feel better about, you know, being able to hit the ground running when all of this is over. Just like Chris said, line up and wait and rev up the power and just get ready to release the brakes. Because that time will come. It'll probably be, it's not going to be like a day where it's like, okay, the virus is over, everybody go back to work. It's going to be pretty slow as it kind of starts to fade away and all that good stuff. But if somebody wants to get into flying, the other part of that answer there, if somebody wants to get into flying, but they're just discouraged, is that right? Is that kind of what you were asking?
Well, maybe even in the middle of training right now. And they're discouraged, just regardless of the virus.
We've all been there. That's called a learning plateau. And I know you know that well, Chris. I know it well. I've run into it with students before. I've run into it many times myself. Like in terms of editing, I still do all the time. I was going to say in terms of editing, the last couple of days has been really hard for me editing this AQP series because I hit a creative block. And I had a phone call with Dan earlier. I had a phone call with another friend earlier, and we're just talking about creative blocks and how sometimes it's just like a brick wall and it feels hopeless that you're never going to get through this. And then I don't know what happened. Somebody said something to me yesterday and it was just like a perfect pair of words that made it click. And I got this idea of like, let me rewrite the script. And I wadded up the video. I was almost done editing it, but I didn't like it. And I wadded it up and threw it in the trash and I started over and I'm almost done with it. That's 24 hours later, you know? So same thing with flight training. You're going to hit a plateau. You're going to level off. And it feels like you can't get your landings right. Or you can't, you know, just radio work is that one thing that keeps holding you back or whatever it may be. Just keep going. Your instructor has the expertise, hopefully, to know that we need to step away from that topic, step into something else. It's all part of the fundamentals of instructing when you become a CFI. But just keep going. That you have no idea how much people like, you know, Chris or I have struggled throughout flight training just to get past something simple. Like, yeah, for me, back when I was learning how to fly, crosswind landings were difficult. Like I don't know why I just couldn't get it. And now I can do it in my sleep. Like, you know, in the 172, right. You know exactly where to put everything. And it's just practice. Keep practicing just like anything else. And you're going to get through it. So try not to get discouraged. And if you do, just know that you are not alone. We've all been there and we all got through it.
I want to hear from someone that did not have any challenges because I've never met that unicorn before.
No, they don't exist.
They don't exist. It's just everyone goes through this. It's pretty tough.
If somebody says they went through flight training with no real challenges, they're a liar.
Or they're going to get a payback soon.
It'll
rear its ugly head.
Yeah. It's kind of like people talk about flying tailwheel. It's like you've either had a ground loop or you're going to have a ground loop.
And then there's a flip side of that, right? I mean, I think it's careful not to be too down in the dumps about how hard it is because like coming full circle, then you get to have experiences like you and I had flying up the Ruth Gorge by ourselves at midnight in still air. Like I get the chills thinking about amazing. Mm-hmm. And those are the types of life experiences you get to have that really like, for me, it like touches my soul.
Oh yeah.
It's unlocked through aviation essentially.
Right. And it's unlocked through hard work and persistence and perseverance. And you've just got to keep pushing and keep applying yourself and don't let yourself, you know, get complacent or think that you've got this down because the moment you let your guard down, it's going to slap you across the face. Just keep going through your training. You're going to hit hard spots. You're going to hit really challenging things that are super hard to get through, but you just got to keep going. And then like Chris said, you know, where you eventually get to a point where it's just, you find yourself in a position where it's like, holy crap, I'm here and I'm doing this and I don't have an instructor sitting next to me. I mean, of course I had an instructor sitting next to me in the gorge, but you know, you get the idea. Like we're just a couple of buddies that are flying up this like magnificently beautiful place that like you couldn't even imagine in your wildest dreams. And like, we're here, we're actually doing this. We're both pilots. We both worked hard to get to this point. And it's those kind of moments where it really pays off. So just hang tight and you'll come across those moments. Meanwhile, go watch YouTube videos.
Yes. So actually, let's pivot there because I was going to end with asking you where people can find your stuff and where you would direct them if you came across them.
Yeah. So I make all of my videos through YouTube, at least right now. That's where I'm posting them. It's youtube.com/aviation101. Or if you don't want to go through YouTube, it'll take you there anyways. But aviation101.com, right there on the homepage, I have an embedded feed of my YouTube channel. I've got, you know, like 10 years worth of videos. There's a lot of them that are unlisted that I'm going to go back and kind of actually something interesting that I want to do is I have all these videos of my flight training when I was getting my private. I want to go back and do like a me now reacting to watching those.
Ooh.
So that's what I'm, stuff. That's what I'm saving like that deep dark archive for. But
that's awesome. But yeah, that's good stuff.
Aviation 101 on YouTube, aviation101.com.
And then on your website as well, you're doing something really cool called the Cockpit Club. Tell people about that quick.
Yeah, so that's basically like a paid side of the website. And for the members on Cockpit Club, I do some exclusive videos. Like I'll edit together the full length cuts of a flight. You know, like for example, flying from Borrego Valley to Torrance through SoCal. That video is maybe like 15, 16 minutes on YouTube, but the actual flight was like an hour and 10 minutes or something like that. So I'll cut that full length flight together and put that on Cockpit Club for people to just watch and learn. Maybe they'll learn something. Maybe they'll, I know I'm of that nerd level where I could sit down and watch a 2 hour video of somebody flying,
right?
You know, listening to the radio calls, all that kind of stuff. So I do that for the members on Cockpit Club. I also do monthly live streams. Talk about current topics, what's happening with the channel. I'll have guests on there. We'll eventually get you on there. And then I do like a drawing once every quarter, so 4 times a year where I do a giveaway. Last time I gave away a Lightspeed flight bag, a headset, all that kind of stuff. So that's a Cockpit Club.
All right. And then for our series, for our time together, people can find all that material on your channel at youtube.com/aviation101. I know you have an Alaska playlist there. Right. And people are addicted to that, man. Like I get messages every day about people that still love that series. So definitely go check it out. So you can kind of see our co-mingling together.
Right. I get sucked into it whenever I start watching it again. If I like take a day off and turn on my TV in the living room and just watch part one, I'm going to watch the whole series.
Yep. Yep. I'll probably go watch some now just because we brought up good memories.
Yep.
Well, thanks for joining us and we'll get all get through this time and you and I will be together again sometime soon to collaborate and give people even more stuff to laugh about or roll their eyes about. So
both,
we'll get there
for sure. But both. Yeah, we'll make it happen again soon. Humanity always bounces back.
Yep, it does. We'll get there. All right. Thanks, buddy, for all you do and see you soon.
Same, man. We'll see you.
All right. A huge thanks to Josh for joining us on AviatorCast. It was great to have him finally. He's been a friend for a handful of years now, but we were finally put it together that we should do an interview. So thanks, Josh, for all you do. And make sure to go check him out on YouTube if you haven't already. You will not regret subscribing to his material and watching. There's always something to learn, and it is definitely entertaining. He just does such a great job. So go check him out. And kind of along the lines of what we are talking about in our podcast, if you guys are looking for ground school right now, that is something that we do here at Angle of Attack. Go check out our private or instrument ground school at angleofattack.com. If you're preparing for a check ride, we also do Check Ride Ace, which is a for private instrument commercial, a check ride preparation program that I know that you can find useful. So those are the things you can do to support us. Make sure to subscribe to this video. Subscribe to us if you haven't already. Like this video, comment. It's great to have you here. Hope you got something valuable out of this today. And we will talk to you next time. Until then, throttle on.
We sincerely thank you for joining us on AviatorCast. Please subscribe through your favorite podcast service and leave a review. Check out more flight training resources at angleofattack.com. There you can find this podcast, many free aviation training videos, as well as online ground school for private instrument, commercial, and CFI. Got a check ride coming up? Check Ride Ace from Angle of Attack is your ultimate companion, guiding you through the process so you can conquer your big day. Thanks once again for joining us on AviatorCast. Turn left, contact Ground Point Niner.